You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM and Melting Pot. The music you just heard comes from Kamasi Washington and his brand new three-volume set of music, appropriately titled The Epic. That is the song that leads off this this album, Change of the Guard, from Kamasi Washington and this exceptional group that he's put together for what is a truly exceptional record. And he is actually here in our studios. We have a chance to talk with him. How are you doing, Kamasi?
I'm pretty good.
I want to thank you just for coming in. It seems like you've been here at KPFK a few times, but maybe one of the first times kind of getting to talk about your own music and kind of
do this kind of thing. You see, I'm in the room playing some music. So
this cool. You were here last night with Carlos and his final Spaceway show.
Yeah, that was an amazing experience. Yeah. I was so glad to be a part of that.
Yeah, but you're here now to talk about your music and about this record, The Epic, which is just getting ready to come out. And I want to kind of dig deep into this record, but I do want to talk just a little bit about you and kind of your biography and kind of how you came into music. You're native Los Angelian.
Yeah.
And have been here and kind of raised in the early 1990s, kind of coming of age during that period of time. In South Los Angeles during that period of time, this is kind of the moment where especially NWA kind of put South LA, Compton, other areas kind of on the map.
Yeah.
And it seems strange in some ways, kind of seems strange for somebody coming up at that time to kind of move towards this music as opposed to kind of straight hip hop. And so I was interested if you could talk just a little bit about kind of that upbringing and how you find your way to the saxophone and to these styles of music.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like you expected, I was into like gangster rap. I was in NWA and Dr. Dre and, you know what I mean, Tupac and that whole style of music. That was, you know, it was the sound of my neighborhood, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
What you heard of your neighbors playing, it's what heard, you know what I mean? All your peers. But my dad is a musician. So jazz was always in my life. I didn't fall in love with it until I had a cousin that gave me a Art Blakely and a Jazz Messengers mixtape.
Nice.
He had a tape of some Art Blakely songs, and I dug Art Blakely. Something about Art Blakely and the drums that Dre was doing, they felt the same to me. I don't know. Just Art Blakely spoke to me.
Yeah.
He was the first person that really spoke to me on that level.
Mm-hmm.
So my dad had this big record collection. So then I was like, I should go look and see if he had some Art Blakey records. And of course he did. And that opened the door. And that's, you know, I've been playing music my whole life. You know, I've been playing music since I was 2 years old.
Yeah.
But I was, it's just for fun. I wasn't a musician. I just wanted to play music, you know? And when I discovered jazz, you know, I was probably around about 9 or 10. I was playing clarinet. And then maybe about 3 years into like really kind of discovering the music, I switched over to saxophone, and that's when that my whole life changed.
Could you talk about that moment? I'm always really interested in, especially kind of like a moment of discovery or a moment of inspiration with musicians, and it seems like finding the saxophone was kind of like that moment.
Yeah.
As you were saying, it really changed you from being somebody who played music into seeing yourself as a musician.
Exactly. Yeah, it was surreal for me too, because it was my dad was a musician. He's a saxophone player, and so he wouldn't let me play saxophone. He made me play clarinet because he said, you know, if you're gonna be a saxophone player, you gotta play clarinet, flute, and saxophone. And so saxophone is probably the easiest of the three. I didn't know that though. He told me the clarinet and saxophone were the same thing. So if you can't play the clarinet, you can't play the saxophone. So I was over here trying to learn these Wayne Shorter and these, you know, Charlie Parker, and I was trying to learn all this, you know, all these solos and these tunes. And it was hard on clarinet, man. Yeah. I was like, man, these dudes. I was like, this is impossible. How are they doing this? You know what I mean? And he had a rehearsal, and one day he left his saxophone out at the rehearsal. And I was like, man, I'm going to play this saxophone. I'm going to just see what this is. You know what I mean? Because all my favorite musicians were saxophone players. So other than Lee Morgan, who was my favorite, one of my favorites too. But most of my favorite musicians were saxophone players.
Yeah.
So I picked it up. And like, the first time I played a saxophone, I played my favorite song at that time. It was Wayne Shorter's Sleeping Dancer, Sleep On. And I just played it immediately. I didn't even know what the fingerings were. I didn't know anything. I just picked it up. First time I played it, I played that song. And I was like, it was like a moment of like, okay, this is my voice. This is what I'm supposed to be doing. You know what I mean? And he heard it, and I ran and started like, look, see, I can play saxophone already. And he was like, okay. So then he took me to his friend Calvin's house. This was back in the day when there was no YouTube.
Yeah.
And Calvin had a lot of videos. So Calvin had a video of Eric Dolphy. And that was really it. When I saw Eric Dolphy playing with, he had a video of Eric Dolphy playing with Charles Mingus.
Mm.
And I was hooked, you know. Left turn in my life, you know.
Yeah. Do you think that, because when I hear your saxophone playing, in contrast to a lot of other contemporary players, where I feel like I hear them and I can kind of immediately pick up their influence in like really direct ways. And with your stylings on the saxophone, like I feel like there are so many voices that come through, and it's a very kind of individual kind of sound the way, and it also translates to the sound of the groups and kind of the performances as well. Yeah. That there isn't a single inspiration. It's very much a melding of these different inspirations. Do you think that kind of delayed reaction to the sound, like not being able to pick it up immediately and like immediately kind of tailor your sound to Charlie Parker or to Wayne Shorter on saxophone as opposed to on clarinet. You think that had some effect on kind of giving you more of a singular kind of voice?
I think it's actually more. There's a historic kind of cultural thing that has happened where the industry of jazz music has kind of overlooked Los Angeles. You know, my dad was a musician, so I knew his friends, and my dad and a lot of his friends were really brilliant musicians.
Like,
really, really, really brilliant. And I used to always wig out. I was like, how is Norty Deadman not famous? I used to just trip out because he was so good, you know? And a similar thing happened to myself and the guys in my band where, like, we worked a lot. Like, my first tour was Snoop Dogg. You know, my second tour was with Rafael Sadiq. My third was with Lauryn Hill. So it was in the jazz world. I mean, Gerald Wilson was one of my mentors, and he saw us and he saw me and he looked after me. But outside of that, it wasn't a whole lot of people when I was younger that really paid attention to me as a jazz musician. Mm. So I think I never stopped playing jazz. I never stopped cultivating my sound, but. So there's a part of the jazz community, and it's very prominent now, that there's a pressure for musicians to conform and to prove that they have a mastery of the musics of the masters that came before them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I never had that pressure, you know. No one ever tried to make me do it. I never had to do a, you know, a John Coltrane tribute album. You know what I mean? I always just made the music that I wanted to make. And so, yeah, those influences are all in me. I have a lot of influences, but they're all over the place. And like you said, you can't really pinpoint one because I've never felt the need to prove these things. You know what I mean? So when I play music, I just play what I want to play.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to, like, show that I can play bebop. Because if I try to show that I can play bebop, I'll sound like Charlie Parker.
Yeah.
If I try to show that I have that, you know what I mean, that I have this mastery of, you know, post-bop or hard bop, then I'll start sounding like those people. But
yeah.
I don't do that. I just play whatever I want to play. And also everybody in my band does the same thing. So that we have this sound that we've been cultivating because we've known each other since we were little kids, like literally since elementary school. Like I've been friends with most of the people in my band before music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we just all happened to end up getting really good at it. But, you know, it's not like, you know, so I think it's actually that. I think it's actually more that. Me starting late could have something to do with it. You know what I mean? But it's also, you know, music, I have a very, it's different when you have a parent that's a musician. Like, I grew up with music. It's like, I didn't have, like, sit-down lessons. It was just like, whenever I was playing music, there was somebody yelling, hey, put the metronome on. You know what I mean? Hey, you ain't playing the changes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you playing out of tune. Mm-hmm. You know, my mom was a musician, too. So it was like, that's my relationship with music is almost like, you know what I mean, it's not so formal.
Hmm. It also seems in you talking about kind of finding your own voice and your own style and how influential being here in Los Angeles and being around the community of musicians here in Los Angeles, both the ones that are that you're kind of closest with and that you continue to play with and that are all kind of, I guess, together in kind of a collective, the West Coast Get Down.
Yeah.
And the kind of somewhat overlooked, as you were saying, tradition of quite a lot of amazing jazz players coming out of Los Angeles. You know, just thinking about Buddy Collette and Eric Dolphy both being here in Los Angeles for long periods of time. Horace Tapscott and a lot of his sound, I think, kind of relates to some of the things going on this record. But specifically with the kind of crew of musicians that you currently have around you and that you were saying you've had even before you were a musician, kind of you spent your childhood together. I was wondering just kind of what that experience, how you feel that experience, that closeness with these other musicians has also affected kind of the way you make music.
Yeah, it gives me a confidence. You know, I know they understand me, so I don't have to slow down. You know, a lot of times you're playing music, it's communication. But it's like, imagine like, you know, you're talking to someone, and so usually you talk to someone, you say what you have to say, and then you kind of explain it, and then you re-explain it. And I don't have to do that with them. I can just go, and they know exactly what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And they, same thing with them. They can just go. They can, you know, there's not a chord that Cameron Graves can play behind me that I won't know what to do with. So he feels open to do whatever he wants to do, and I feel open. I know there's no note I can't play that I can play that Miles Mosley isn't going to know the right bass note to play to go with it.
Yeah.
So I just feel like it makes the music move really fast, and it feels seamless. Like it's a lot, you know. Like when I went back to like the way I recorded it, I recorded the band itself without the strings and choir, and then I wrote the strings and choir around what they were doing.
Okay.
And I was tripping off because, like, you know, I mean, even though we played together for decades, you know what I mean? Like, I never transcribed for Cameron Graves solo. So in doing this, I basically was kind of transcribing my friend's solos, and I was like, man, this is difficult. You know what I mean? Like, you ain't gonna play the same chord once? You know what I mean? Can we get one repeat of a chord? One repeat of something?
Yeah.
You know? And so it was like, you know, it let me realize. I was like, oh, wow, I didn't even think about how much intuition is going on, is happening in between us. And that has to be just us. Because I don't just know Cameron musically. I know Cameron personally. I know his mom. I know his dad. Mm. You know what I mean? I know he used to be. I'm not going to bust him out. But, you know, I know what he used to be into. You know, I know. You know, like, you know, when I met Ronald Bruner, he wasn't potty trained. So, you know, it's a different kind of, you know, connection that happens when it's like that. You know?
Yeah, and I think it really comes through in the music. I mean, especially when you think about jazz recordings, maybe more than any other contemporary genres. A lot of times, you know, studio sessions are kind of like that. This may be the first time people have come together in order to make music. And sometimes it gels and sometimes it doesn't, no matter how great the artistry is of the players. But that feeling, that kind of bond that you guys have comes through really clearly in the music and the seamlessness, I think was how you described it. And that does seem to be a quality that comes through in this work, which is fascinating because, I mean, this is an epic album. It is. I don't know exactly. How did you choose? I mean, it's just looking at it, you know, spread out over three parts. It's close to 3 hours of music. There's the kind of 10-piece group that you have kind of cultivated over the years, but then there's the addition of a 32-piece orchestra, a large choir. It seems in some ways a very obvious choice to call this record the epic, but I was wondering how the title for the album came together and whether or not it also connects to kind of the kind of inspiration that seemed to be behind some of this music as well.
Well, it's interesting. So how I recorded this album, you know, Lotus hit me up, Flying Lotus hit me up and said, hey, you want to do a record for Brainfeeder? And I was like, yeah. So I asked him, so what kind of record are you thinking about having me make? And he was like, whatever you want to do. And that just freed me up. I was like, that was weird. It was a real quick little conversation, but it opened the door in a different kind of way for me.
How long ago was that?
That was a long time ago. I can't even tell you. That was probably 2010.
Okay, yeah.
So, you know, it's hard as a musician, you know, you're working. I think I was on tour at that point. I wasn't even home. And so when I got back home, got some time together, I started calling all my guys. You know what I mean? Hey, I'm going to need you guys for a couple of days, maybe 3 or 4 days to record this record for Brain Feeder. And so everybody I called was like, man, I need to record some music too. So I was like, well, why don't we do this? Why don't we just all record each other's music? You know what I mean? Why don't we just take a month and commit to each other? We commit to so many other people for so long. We go on tours all the time, and you can commit months and months to people. Let's commit 1 month to each other. So we took 1 month in 2011, took December of 2011, locked out of studio, didn't take any gigs, you know, and just recorded each other's music all day, every day, like 11 o'clock in the morning to 2 o'clock in the morning.
Mm.
And it was great. So, you know, we ended up with like this crazy amount of music. It was like 190 songs, 8 albums, like 2 terabytes worth of music. It was crazy. So I walked away with 45 songs.
All right.
So I couldn't put out 45 songs. So, I showed Lotus, hey, I got 45 of these songs. And he's like, okay, well, let me know when you work that out. So I worked it down to the 17 that I really felt like really just captured the songs.
You know what
I mean? I hate to use the word perfect, but they were just, I wouldn't change anything about them. It's like, that is the song. That is what it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
And there were 17 of them. So I was really planning on shortening that 17 down into one album.
Okay.
So I started listening to the 17 songs. So I listened to 17 songs, and I started writing to them, writing the strings and choir stuff, just to figure out which songs I was going to make the record. And it's going to sound weird, I started having this dream, this like kind of surreal dream about this guy on the top of a mountain guarding this gate, and there was these people in the village that lived at the bottom of the mountain, and all they wanted to do was challenge the guy so they could become the guy. And it was this whole thing. I'm actually going to explain the whole story on my show, the release show on May 4th.
Okay.
But it was in that story, and it was reoccurring. I had it like 10, 11 times or something like that. And then I started like daydreaming it in the day, and like I just kind of cultivated into this really long, drawn out thing, and had each song on the record was attached to a piece of the story.
Okay.
So then it became even harder for me to try to decide which one of these songs is not going to make on the record, because there's a story that's going along with it, and I'm like, something's telling me that, you know, someone's just telling me, hey, come on. I said, this is the album. So I was like, all right, this is the album. This must be the album. This must be it. Even the whole sequence of the album was because of the story, the way the disc, you know, the plan, the glorious tale, and the historic repetition, that all kind of came from the story, even though it does have a relevance in real life as well. But it really came from the story.
Okay.
So I went back to Lotus and I was like, hey, man. He was like, so what songs are going to be on the record? And I was like, all 17? It'll be a triple disc. And he just kind of laughed and was like, I knew you were going to do that. And he was like, all right, let's do it. And that was it. That's how it happened.
Wow. Yeah, and in talking about that, you kind of answer a question that I had about this record, because it is split into these three parts. And as you mentioned, volume one is called The Plan, volume two, The Glorious Tale, and volume three, Historic Repetition. And there is this kind of overarching story that connects to this dream, but it also seems like each volume kind of tells a story. In some cases, even individual songs tell a story by themselves. But I was wondering how you kind of came up with the idea of the three different volumes.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you. I mean, so I'll tell it to you in a real life version. I mean, there's a story version that kind of mirrors real life. So I'll give you the real life.
That's
so
cool.
Real life. In real life, so you have the plan. So, you know, as a musician, you grow up and you have these goals and you have these dreams, you know, to be something and to do something. And so you work really hard. I mean, like any really great musician has had a time where they were obsessed with music. You know, I used to practice 8-10 hours a day. That's all I did. My mom thought I was crazy. She thought I was depressed or something, because I wasn't hanging out with my friends anymore. She has to call a psychologist to come and see if I was okay, you know. So you do that, and you imagine this world, you know, of your heroes, like of the Miles Davises and John Coltrane, and traveling the world, spreading love and peace and creativity and bringing light all over the world. And so you do that, and then so you try to prepare yourself. I'm going to get to that level. I'm going to build myself up to where I can play anything, and I'm going to change the world. You know what I mean? So you get this plan to do these things. You know, and then you get ready. You know, you're 18, 19 years old. You're playing all kinds of music. You know, you've taken your instrument to the edge of what it can possibly do. And then you realize, oh, the world has changed.
Mm.
You know, this isn't really what is happening anymore. You know, and that's kind of what happened to a lot of us. Like, we got to this level, and we get out in the world, and the world has changed.
Mm.
You know, those doors aren't necessarily open like that.
Yeah.
So that's the plan. That's what happened to the plan. That's why you have songs like Change of the Guard, The Next Step, Final Thought. You know what I mean? The rhythm changes. It's all about, like, your preparation. And then sometimes you prepare to go left, but sometimes you got to go right.
Yeah.
So then the glorious tale is about what happens when you go right. You know, I've had a beautiful life. You know what I mean? Like I said before, I mean, coming up in high school, practicing the way I did, studying the way I did, like doing what I was doing in music, I wasn't doing that in the thought that, like, oh, my first tour is going to be playing with Snoop in the horn section.
Mm.
But it was. And I learned a lot, actually. You know, musically, not just life. I learned a lot about life because I was different.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, you know, it changed me for a little while, but I got my head back together. But but musically, it opened my mind to a different way of looking at music. And it was, you know, then like playing Raphael Sadiq opened my mind to a whole nother way of looking at music. And then Lauryn Hill opened my mind to another way of looking at music. Then Gerald Wilson opened my mind. I had all these experiences, you know, Harvey Mason and Stanley Clark, and I got to play like with my hero, McCoy Tyner. Like, all these things opened my mind. So it's a really glorious tale, even though it wasn't my plan. Even though it wasn't my plan was to come out, go on the road, and play my jazz compositions, and I was going to, you know what I mean? That was my plan. But my tale was glorious, and it was different than my plan. And then the final part of that happens. That happens to, like, my, like, you know, growing up, talking to my dad, it's like that same thing happened to him and his friends.
Hmm.
You know, so the historic repetition is that is going to happen to everyone.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? I mean, even I've seen clips of Sonny Rollins, and he talks the same way. I heard, you know, I've seen clips of, like, Eric Dolphy talking about how excited he was. He actually had his own shows in Europe. I'm like, wow, that sounds like us.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You read these biographies, and so you realize, like, oh, this always happens. You have a plan. You prepare for life. Then life happens. And then the final piece of the puzzle is your perspective on it.
Mm.
And if you adjust your perspective in the right way, you end up with something beautiful. And so the historic repetition is that. It was my own level of, like, adjusting my perspective to, like, because, you know, I think, you know, happiness is derived from recognizing your ambitions and accepting and appreciating your realities, you know? So, like, I had to recognize my ambitions. Like, what do I want? Okay, this is what I want. And what do I have? Oh, wow, I have all of this. Okay, well, yeah, so let me just keep moving towards what I want, because I've already accumulated all this. So that's what that is. That's why, you know, he's talking about Malcolm's name, change, and, like, understanding, like, listening to him talk, it sounds like he's talking about now.
Like, literally today.
Yeah, it sounds like he's talking about today. You know, but he's talking about 1965, you know. And, you know, the Clair de Lune, he's like, I made it into a blues, even though, like, the blues didn't even exist when he wrote that song, but it did, because it's in there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just that symbiotic kind of, like, parallel universe of time that, like, you know, you think everyone thinks their generation is the one that's getting the shaft, but it's not. You know what I mean? It's every generation is beautiful. Every step along this journey is beautiful. You just have to look at it in the right way. So that's what it means in the real. Even though that's pretty.
No, it's fantastic and also adds to the multiple levels, because I think in some ways the kind of the story about the dream is kind of be part of the story of this record, and you know, that's the one that people will kind of know more. And to hear you talk about kind of the stories around the stories in some ways, really beautiful to hear. And in talking about these three volumes of the epic, you know, gives us greater context for the song that we led into with the interview, Change of the Guard. Also greater context to what we'll probably close with from that last volume, Historic Repetition. The middle moment, Glorious Tale, they're with this, I mean, they're kind of, as I was saying earlier, each of the songs themselves almost seems to tell a story kind of connected to other songs within each volume. Some of them seem to kind of stand by themselves. The Glorious Tale, just from my ears, and it's still pretty, this record's really, really new to me. And mm-hmm. so my feelings about it haven't quite settled in terms of how I feel about all this music.
Yeah.
But the Glorious Tale feels to me, the music there feels the most personal of the three volumes. Some of it may be connected to the fact that there are multiple songs that seem directly connected to people misunderstanding the way the title is phrased. Kind of seems like it's directly connected to someone, Leroy and Lanisha, and also Henrietta, our hero, and the Magnificent Seven. Like, it all seems to be connected to kind of more specific things. I was really interested in Henrietta, our hero. There are a number of songs on this album. There's kind of, with the choir, there's kind of a wordless singing with some things. But then there are a number of songs where primarily it's Patrice Quinn doing vocals with lyrics. And Henrietta, our hero, is one of those songs. And the story of it seems very personal. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that track in particular.
Yeah, Henrietta, our hero, is a song I wrote for my grandmother. Mm-hmm. So my grandmother, Henrietta Curtis, was an amazing, amazing woman. She raised my dad and my two uncles.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all very successful, very amazing men. You know, my uncle's a lawyer. My other uncle runs the Little Washington Dance Theater, wrote for the LA Times. My dad's a professional musician, traveled around the world, you know, taught for 30 years, you know, raised six children, you know what I mean? So my grandmother was a victim of basically mental health malpractice, you know, back in the 50s.
Yeah.
My dad was a baby. She was committed, and, you know, just for mild depression.
Yeah.
And they gave her shock treatment.
Yeah.
And just messed her up. You know, and so she struggled with mental health after that. But despite that, she was only about 4 feet tall. You know what I mean? Despite that, she bought a home, raised three children by herself, helped all three of her children buy their first house, gave myself and my brother and a few of my cousins our first car, helped raise me and two of my brothers, yeah. You know what I mean? And, you know, it was my sisters. You know, she came to my dad's house twice a week and just would just come and just clean up the house and take care of us because my parents were divorced. And she was just an amazing, powerful woman that just, you know, despite all of her frailties, like, was the rock of our family. And I used to trip up sometimes, like, man, there's some powerful, big, strong, I'm 6 foot three, you know, my brother's 6 foot five, we're some big, strong mm-hmm. men, you know, doctors and lawyers and all these other people in this family. And we all lean on grandma, you know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah.
And she was like, you know, and she held it down. It made it so I had no excuse ever. It's like, man, she stretched what she had to something so amazing. You know what I mean? She did such an amazing job with so little.
Yeah.
In a time that was so difficult, you know. Never on welfare. Never, you know what I mean? Never take a handout from anyone. You know, three sons through college. You know what I mean? She's one of my heroes. Anytime I'm thinking like, Getting feeling sorry for myself, I'm like, you know. So that's what that song is about. It's about, you know. And there's a lot of heroes like that, and they go on celebrated.
Yeah,
you know, we live in such a masculine world where it's all about competition, and we celebrate the victors of competition. But like someone like her, who just was compassionate and just did what she was supposed to do.
Yeah.
We don't recognize that too often. Not in any widespread way, you know. Usually, someone's making a song about their grandmother's because she became a judge or a surgeon or something. Like, no, my grandmother didn't do any of that, but she was still a hero because she, you know, she helped people, and that's what a hero is. I mean, you know, it's great to have accomplishments, but sometimes it's just like we can celebrate someone who just helped people, and that's all she did in her whole life was just help people.
Yeah, it's a beautiful sentiment, and it comes through in the song. Why don't we actually hear this song right now? This is Kamasi Washington we've been talking with here at KPFK, and this is a song that is featured on his upcoming record, just soon to be released, called The Epic, on volume number 2 of The Epic, The Glorious Tale. This is the tale of Henrietta, our hero, that you're hearing right now on KPFK and Melting Pot.
A story.
You just heard music from Kamasi Washington from his album, The Epic. The name of the song was Henrietta, Our Hero, a song dedicated to his grandmother, as you just heard him tell the story behind that song. We've been talking with him about his life as a musician, his music, and particularly this this new record, the first new music from you in quite some time. It's like, now we understand why it's been a little while since we had music just kind of with your name, kind of your music. It's something that's been, you've been working on for a long time, appropriately titled The Epic. We've been talking about this record and continue talking a little bit about it. One of the things I was wondering about with an album like this, and particularly in the way that you were saying how this, how everything, the kind of different steps and kind of bringing it to fruition. Most of the times I associate you with large groups, with 8, 9, 10 players.
Mm-hmm.
But there's large groups, and then there's what's going on here, which is a really, really large group. Again, you know, the kind of 10-piece band as a principals, and then augmented by a 32-piece orchestra, a 20-person choir. And I was wondering how it would seem to be, like, just to somebody who doesn't compose music, the whole kind of process of composing all these different parts for all these different people, it seems like it would cause some kind of mental health issue, like schizophrenia or something like that. Well, I think there would be different challenges kind of creating music or making music with, you know, 9 or 10 players versus creating music for a large ensemble like this. But could you talk a little bit about kind of translating the music, I guess, in some ways, from what should be a larger group, but turns out to be a very smaller group compared to this orchestra and the choir and everything put together?
Yeah. There's a depth you get with large ensembles that you can't really get with smaller ensembles.
Mm.
There's counter melodies, there's different depths of harmony, there's just so many more textures you can get. The music, you can make great music with one person. But the depth and the possibilities get limited. So the more people you have, the more possibilities you have. So, and then in those possibilities, there comes this depth, and it comes this sense of, you know, music is great. Music has a kind of has a balance of the known and unknown. Mm. You know, so like having that depth gives you like this, you know this one is coming, but you just don't know what is coming, and that's what causes that enjoyment, and that's what makes people, you know what I mean, draws people's attention to the music.
Yeah.
So for me, you know, I've played in a lot of large ensembles and I've played in small ensembles. So the advantage of the small ensembles is that because there's less people, it could be the music can be more free. Mm-hmm. You can move it, you can manipulate it more with more ease and with less preparation. Mm-hmm. And that's how we like to play. We like to play on the edge where, you know, like, I start the song, but I have no idea how the song is going to end.
Yeah.
I definitely don't know what's going to happen in the middle.
Yeah.
You know? And that's what I wanted. I want to keep that. I want to keep that freedom of expression. Because a lot of times with larger ensembles, you have to make an arrangement, which you kind of have to keep to so that you can stay together, you know? So what I did in this, and this is a different way of doing this, is I took a small group and let them be free. And let them move, shape the music in that wherever they wanted, where they wanted to do it. And then I went behind that and wrote string and choir arrangements around that to give it that depth, yeah, that texture. And that, and there's something powerful about a choir and like a human voice and strings. There's something earthly about the strings. It feels like the woods, and feels, I don't know, it feels like the earth.
Yeah.
So I wanted to add those elements. And but I want to keep the freedom and the spirit, especially of jazz, of like freedom and like nonconformance. It's like, so like, I didn't put any restrictions on the band members. In fact, I was pushing them probably more than they wanted to be pushed to stretch. I was like, man, I need more. I need you to, you know, I need more of you, Brandon Coleman. I need more of you, Tony Austin. I need more of you, Miles Mosley. You know, and that's what they did. You know, like, you know, Ryan Porter would take solos and just add all this soul that I could then go and write around, mm-hmm, you know, because it gave me musical, inspiration to create even more stuff. So that's the way I did it.
Now, with that kind of process, it seems like there would be things that kind of came to mind after the kind of initial recordings with the 10-piece group. But it would also seem like you would have had some things in mind kind of prior to recording things with the smaller group. And some of that might be connected to the use of voices. It's kind of where it would seem to me, at least, where that would kind of come out most, perhaps. Because there are songs where the choir is utilized where they are, what I call kind of wordless singing.
Yeah.
Connected to it. And then there are a number of tracks, again, principally with Patrice Quinn as the main vocalist, but also in some cases with choir behind, where there are particular lyrics. And I would imagine those songs where she is singing, those would have been with those initial sessions?
Yeah.
Okay. So that clears one thing up. But was there some, like some things that you kind of had an idea in your head, like how it would end up sounding, something like change of the guard or something along those lines, and other things that as you recorded the original music, kind of new inspiration came out?
I had a vision in my head before we did any of it.
Okay.
I had this vision in my head. I was hearing, I knew the songs, and I was imagining it, and I knew the players.
Mm-hmm.
I knew the musicians that were going to play the songs. I knew the songs. And I always want the string and choir thing, that was always what I was planning on doing.
Yeah.
I tried my best not to, because I wanted to leave the musicians free to do what they wanted to do, to not impose that vision onto them. I just wanted to let the music be what it was going to be. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, you have a baby.
Did you even tell them much about kind of how you were envisioning the final product?
I didn't. I just told them I wanted them to play more.
Yeah.
They were kind of like, I am playing Kumasi. I'm like, well, I need you to play more. You know, like you said, we were in that studio for 12 hours a day.
Yeah.
So tensions got a little high. Like, boom, pushing me. You know, but so I can honestly say that, like, the record actually came out better than what I was imagining.
Hmm.
You know, I had this thought of what I wanted. And actually, ironically enough, it was, you know, I was pushing the musicians because I know how much they can play. And I know how far they can go.
Yeah.
So I was trying to push them to the edge. And I don't know, maybe the universe is just looking out for me. God, you know, like, they weren't necessarily going to the edge that I wanted them to go to. And I was just like, and they were just like, man, I'm playing what I hear. That's everyone kept saying to me now. So yeah. I was like pushing. I was like a slave. I had like my little blowhorn. You know, I didn't have a blowhorn, but I was pushing them.
Yeah.
And then when I went back to write the strings and stuff, I was like, oh, see, they were just intuitively, even though they didn't know that I was going to write strings for this stuff, leaving room for me to do that. Do you know? It was uncanny. I was like, because had they gone as far as I wanted them to go, it wouldn't have been room.
Hmm.
You know, but they didn't. They went the perfect amount.
Yeah.
Right where it was perfect. So that when I added the strings, it felt natural. And they didn't collide. And they didn't, and it, you know, it was perfect. And I was just like, wow, this is better than I thought it. Or this happened almost, you know what I mean? Despite my bumbling and fumbling, you know, it came out, you know, like, you know, you put a thought into the world. And I have pretty grand ambitions sometimes. I mean, like the show I have on May 4th.
Yeah.
It's going to be 35 musicians on stage.
Mm.
And it's going to be different because when I did the record, you know, what the band did, it was just 10 people moving without knowing what was going to happen.
Yeah.
But what the strings were doing with the band, the band was kind of set because it was already pre-recorded.
Yeah.
So for this show, it's not pre-recorded.
Mm-hmm.
So the strings and the choir are going to have to adjust and be connected to us the way we're connected to one another, which is going to add a whole other. And we have like some DJs that are coming in and performing with us. It's going to add a whole other element to it that I'm really myself curious to see how it works. But I just, you know, I like to just, you know, imagine what I want and then just go do it. And not really think about the pitfalls, you know. And that's how I did this record. You know, I was just like, I'm going to record this music, and then I'm going to put these strings and choir on it, and it's going to be great. And that's what happened.
Yeah. And you know, as we were talking about earlier, in terms, we may have been talking about it in a slightly different context, but the music on the album, everything has this seamless quality. Like if you had told us, if you just like stuck to this story that we recorded everything. One take, everybody was in the studio, all 60 people. If you'd told that story, people would have completely believed it based off of the results. Like it sounds as if everything was just played. And there's kind of in terms of the way that it's mixed as well, kind of gives it a certain feel. Like there's a bit of some kind of like the ambient noise of performance when things in are kind of in there.
Yeah.
A lot of times that gets taken out, and it gives a certain quality to being able to listen to this as a full piece, which really I do, you know, it's 3 hours, but it is something that really, you know, like when a movie is 3 hours, but it's an exceptional movie, it feels like, you know, where did the time go?
Yeah.
I want to see it again. Like, that's the feeling that you get in listening to the epic from start to finish. It's a quick 3 hours, and there is, you know, nothing that really could have been taken out. Everything seems to have fallen into place. So it's fascinating to hear that, you know, different stages and the steps and how it was in some ways kind of pieced together in a way that it doesn't seem to be at all, because it has that seamless kind of like cosmic seamless quality to it.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's also the musicians, man. I'm so thankful to the strings and choir that they stuck with me. You know, it was you know, it was different to try to do that. You know,
yeah.
And as I said before, it came out better than I even could have claimed to have imagined it. You know, and it's, you know, a lot of great musicians, a lot of people poured their hearts and soul. You know, like, you know, there's a piece of every single one of those musicians' soul is in that music, you know. It's my idea, but it's a collective thing, you know.
Mm. To talk about just one of the other songs on this record, and again, it's kind of hard to talk about individual tracks just because each individual volume and the entire collection of songs really feels like a full piece altogether. But I did want to talk just a little bit about Malcolm's theme, song where almost verbatim you have a kind of rendition of the eulogy that Ossie Davis gave for Malcolm. And then that is combined with some words from Brother Malcolm, very poignant words. And as we were talking about earlier, that you know, though coming from 1965, sound as if they could have been said today in a really literal sense. And I was just wondering how that particular track came together, and especially kind of the choice to kind of bring music to those words from Ossie Davis, and also to include Malcolm's voice with your music.
Well, then when I think, I think back to when I was a kid, you know.
Mm.
So even before I got into jazz, you know, I was a feisty kid,
mm-hmm.
you know. So I fought a lot, and I was just, you know, I just headed in a bad direction in my life. There's this program that came to my elementary school called Ujima, and this guy named Brother Mark and his friends, Brother Darryl, and a few other really really amazing men. They came and they taught a bunch of rowdy, extra hood, you know, cuz after every word, young men, their history and the realities of the society they lived in. And Malcolm X was one of the people they really taught us about. They gave us his autobiography. And just reading it, it changed my whole life. It changed my whole perspective, you know. And I was already playing music, but, you know, I hadn't really gotten to jazz. And then right around that same time that Malcolm, it changed my perspective in that, like, even the possibility that I would one day be a gangster that hurt people and brought my community down, no way. You know, it's like hearing his Malcolm X's words made that reality an impossibility for me.
Mm.
You know, I had to live my life to help people like he did. It was just, that's how powerful his words were to me.
Mm-hmm.
And in my life, I've always wanted to pay tribute to him, because it's like people don't really realize how much that movement that he was a part of, and how he was a major, major part. I mean, he's not the only one, but he was a major, major, major part of a movement that really is responsible for the world being as progressed as it is. You know,
mm-hmm.
you know, those notions that it's okay to be a bigot. It's okay that you know what I mean? That I should be ashamed of my skin color. I should be ashamed of my hair.
Yeah.
I don't have those feelings.
Yeah.
But it's because of Malcolm.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and he gave his life for that, you know? So it's like, and then, you know, in these recent times we're in with all these killings and all these brutalities and all this pain and suffering, it just feels like, man, like, you just need to go listen to Malcolm.
Mm-hmm.
You just need to go read his book, and you'll be cured.
Yeah.
It's like the medicine, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then I've always loved O.C.'s eulogy. I just felt like it paid tribute to him in a way that could never be replaced.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think so, it's, you know, even hearing this rendition, it's something when I hear the original or heard later versions of him doing it, it's something that almost always brings me to tears. And hearing this rendition as well kind of brings me, you know, by the end, kind of brings me to tears. It's just the words are chosen so beautifully, and they're such a perfect tribute to the person that Malcolm was and kind of what he meant to so many of us.
And it's all love. I mean, like, and there's all these connections, you know. I mean, like, I grew up in the Monk Institute, and Terrence Blanchard, who actually wrote that melody that you hear words are coming from,
mm-hmm.
you know, he works in them. He's the director of the Monk Institute. Patrice Quinn, who's singing the song with Dwight Tribble, her mother worked with Malcolm X.
Mm.
He used to babysit his kids. You know what I mean? So it's one of those things. And then, you know, Malcolm, when you hear what he's talking about, it's like his ideas have expanded beyond just the needs of African Americans. You know, like a great friend of mine, Sophia Tarawa, like when she heard it, she's Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
She thought it was just beautiful, like, that someone was speaking that way about Islam, you know, like, you hear that speech at the end.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things where it had been on my heart for my whole life to be able to pay tribute to him. And it's like, I got this album coming out on Brain Feeder, and like, you know, a lot of people are going to hear it. I got to do it. I have to. You know what I mean? I just have to. Just because he had changed my life. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, he didn't know me.
Yeah.
He didn't know he was going to change my life.
Yeah.
But he did. You know what I mean? And it's just like, it wasn't even a question. It was like, okay, I have to do that. You know, and there's other people that I have to pay tribute to as well. That, you know what I mean? For the albums coming up, I have, you know what I mean? So there's been a lot of people that throughout history that have done things that don't always get a thank you. You know what I mean? People, you know, put their lives, you know what I mean? And they've given their lives for others. And, you know, we don't thank them enough. So. Yeah. That was just my thank you to Malcolm X.
Yeah, and as I said, you know, it's beautifully rendered, and it's incredibly timely, which is both kind of comforting and disheartening at the same time. You know, it's like we feel like so much has changed and so little has changed, kind of at the same time.
Yeah,
and it's great to hear his voice and kind of hear Malcolm all these years later continue to speak truth to insanity and to people trying to misrepresent, in his case, in a very personal, like, misrepresent what he stood for and how he saw things, but trying to misrepresent people in general, and trying to spread truth and also, you know, feelings of deep love. And again, you know, it's of all this music is really exceptional. I think having that be close to the end, it kind of closes with Malcolm's theme, and then the final song, The Message, kind of working really nicely together, just brings everything, you know, together in this just really beautiful way. And so everybody else will be thanking you in all kinds of different manners. I wanted to thank you personally just for creating all this music, and especially for that tribute to Malcolm.
Yeah. It was my honor.
And thank you also so much for coming into the studio and talking to us about this exceptional record and about your life and your musicianship. We're hoping sometime in the summer, if things work out, be able to bring you back and also bring in some of your fellow musicians to perform for us. And that would be fantastic. Hopefully we'll be able to make that happen.
Yeah, we got to do that. That piano in there, it sounds it's calling my name right now. we'll be back for sure.
And again, just thank you so much, Kamasi, for coming in and talking with us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a beautiful thing you're doing over here.
Yeah, thank you. You make it easy.
Oh.
We've been talking with Kamasi Washington here at KPFK and Melting Pot. I wanted to close things off with the song we were talking about a moment ago that is from Volume Number 3, Historic Repetition. This is Malcolm's theme, once again from Kamasi Washington here at KPFK 90.7 FM and Melting Pot. Before us.
I have to straighten out my own position, and which is clear, I am not a racist in any form whatsoever. I don't believe in any form of racism. I don't believe in any form of discrimination or segregation. I believe in Islam. I'm a Muslim, and there's nothing wrong with being a Muslim. nothing wrong with the religion of Islam. That just teaches us to believe in Allah as the God, and those of you who are Christians probably believe in the same God. Because I think you believe in the God who created the universe, and that's the one we believe in, the one who created the universe. The only difference being, you call him God, and we call him Allah. Jews call him Jehovah. If you could understand Hebrew, you'd probably call him Jehovah too. If you can understand Arabic, you'd probably call him Allah. But since the white man, your friend, took your language away from you during slavery, the only language you know is his language, you know, your friend's language. So you call him, you call for the same God he calls for. When he's putting a rope around your neck, you call for God, he calls for God. But the real religion of Islam doesn't teach anyone to judge another human being by the color of his skin. The yardstick that is used by the Muslim to measure another man is not the man's color, but the man's views, the man's conscious behavior, the man's intention. And when you use that as a standard of measurement or judgment, you never go wrong.
No more a man, but a seed which will come forth again. We'll know him as a prince, our own black shining prince, who died because he loved us so.